If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. At the beginning of 2026, Chris DeGaulle was a prominent conservative radio host in the Kansas City area. But flash forward to today, and DeGaulle is one of two major contenders in the Republican primary for Missouri's 6th Congressional District. DeGaulle joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about his campaign for the North Missouri-based seat and why he's the best candidate to succeed retiring Congressman Sam Graves. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in Oralto over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us today from beautiful North Missouri, he is one of two major Republican candidates running for the 6th Congressional District seat in August. Our guest today is
Chris DeGaulle. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today. My first question is a really hard one. Who are you, and what prompted you to get involved in Missouri electoral politics?
I've been asked that one a lot. Not so much who I am, but why do it? Because, you know, politics ain't beanbag. It's an ugly business these days. Everybody knows it. And as a talk show host for 25 years, Jason, and thanks for the opportunity to share a little bit about who I am. I've been in the broadcasting game almost my entire career, talking about issues and interviewing politicians. You know, I've had President Trump on the show 7 times. I was just at the White House after the State of the Union, as a matter of fact, most recently interviewing some members of his cabinet. So I've been in the space of talking with Missourians and people across the country about issues they care about, conservative issues that we all care about, and I've advocated for in the Kansas City metro area first and then nationwide most recently with the Salem Media Group. And when Sam Graves, who represents my home district of North Missouri and the 33 counties that make up North Missouri, I kind of had a decision to make. I have been very disquieted in the last few years about the things I've discussed on the show. They've taken on more seriousness and importance to me, and it's felt a little unsatisfactory to just sit and continue to talk about them. I feel I know specifically how to not only address the issues, but champion the issues, and if need be, do battle when necessary. And so it just seemed like the appropriate time in this 250th year of the country, where average folks founded the country. They came out of their private sector lives and stepped up for a time. That's the way I feel about it. It's stepping out of the comfort of my private sector job of 25 years and representing North Missouri, my home, for a time.
I do have to ask this question. People can't see this on the audio, but I am wearing a Milwaukee Bucks hat. You worked in Philadelphia for a while. Would you agree that Joel Embiid is never going to make the Eastern Conference Finals?
You know, well, there are two things I got to confess. I was never a basketball guy. I was never into Philadelphia sports like the Philadelphia sports were. I lived in Philly for around 10 years total. And I will say this about Philadelphia sports fans. They are rabid. They are believers. They have been trusting the process about the Sixers and Joel Embiid for a long time. But yeah, it appears that you might have bought a lemon there in Joel Embiid. I don't think it's going to materialize based on what I see.
As a long-suffering Bucks fan, I still believe that the 76ers bribed the refs to get to the NBA Finals in 2001 against the Milwaukee Bucks.
Look, I think the NBA has, I mean, when you talk about the bribery scandal and sports and integrity of sports, I think the NBA has a hole to dig out of, don't you?
No, NBA is probably the best sport besides football, but I mean,
Okay.
I'm in the vast majority on that in Missouri. I found that since I moved to Missouri in 2002, people either like baseball, football, we like hockey in St. Louis, but people don't like the NBA for some reason. But you
Yeah.
know, that's why I guess two teams moved out
I
of the
know.
state.
I
But
grew up a Chiefs fan, dyed in the wool. That's always kind of where my loyalties have lied, and that's about where I stay. That's the one I can pay attention to.
well, they're going to have a happy home in Kansas, but that's another
That
story
bums me out.
altogether. You received the endorsement of Graves pretty early in the process, and interestingly, your main opponent, Nathan Willett, seems to think that's a bad thing. He basically has said that this was basically Graves picking his successor, and it was basically a backroom deal. But you've like promoted the fact that he's endorsed you in your advertisements. What do you think it means for the campaign that he is backing you and not your main opponent?
You know, the 25 years I worked in broadcasting, what I left out is there were 2 years that I actually stepped away from the microphone early in Congressman Graves' tenure. I think it was his third term, 2000, might have been four, 2004 to 2006. And I worked as a field representative for him and worked in his comm shop, helped with press releases and those sorts of things. So I got to know a little bit about the operations of the congressman's office. And that really helped me in my broadcast career, in my talk radio career, talking about Congress, because I began to really understand what the function of a congressional office is. The congressman's work with constituent services is second to none in my view. And that was what was impressed upon me early when I did that work. That's what I know he brought to North Missouri was constituent services. And look, are there things after 26 years, I suppose he took a vote or two. We could parse that all day long. But the congressman endorsing this campaign is merely a function of a long-time relationship and friendship with him. And of course, you got to run and win a race on your own. The only endorsement that matters, and I've got a few I could talk about, but the only endorsement that matters are the voters of North Missouri. They don't care who endorses any candidate, really. They're going to give you their endorsement and their vote if they're convinced that you're the guy to send to Washington. So that's what I'm working on doing. But no, is that a negative? I don't think so. And the reason I know the councilman's insincere about that is because he has touted his relationship with Congressman Graves repeatedly on his own social media. He interned for the congressman, and the congressman endorsed him for both his city council race and his state senate race that he was running. So the councilman enjoyed the endorsement of Congressman Graves until he didn't get it for this race, and he's clearly upset about that.
The other thing that Councilman Willett enjoyed was the services of Jeff Rowe until he turned against him and has now been making Jeff Rowe part of his campaign because Jeff Rowe is helping with your campaign. For our listeners who don't know who Jeff Rowe is, and you should, because he is like an omnipresent figure in American life. I'm kidding, by the way. Jeff
I'm
Rowe
sure
and
he'd
I
like that.
talk. Jeff Rowe and I talk occasionally, and I think he enjoys that I like create an outsized view of his power. But you know, he's basically, I think he's attacking you for employing him because he worked for DeSantis. You've seen like advertisements of you making positive statements about Ron DeSantis and negative statements about Donald Trump. Is this just part of like a broader battle in Trump world? Because there's a lot of people in Trump world who don't like Jeff Rowe. I think Jeff Rowe and the president are probably on okay terms now, but there are some people in his orbit that really want to see you lose because they want to stick it to your political consultant. What do you think about that? Before we get into like real issues, I do want to ask that inside baseball question.
So a few things. Number one, Jeff and I have been friends for over 30 years. We were fraternity brothers at Northwest Missouri State before either of us were in any kind of politics or broadcasting or anything. We were just fraternity brothers and college friends. So I've known Jeff personally for a very long time. Having said that, Jeff is not actually the general over this campaign. He's not on this campaign, just to be clear. A gentleman named Sam Cooper is running this campaign. So the relationship there, in terms of his firm and the work that he's done, yes, you're correct to point out that the councilman employed it. The councilman used not only the services of Jeff's company for his city council race, he used it for his state senate race, which he was running and raised a great deal of money. I also helped kick off his state senate race personally and emceed that effort. So it came as a shock to a whole lot of folks who worked very, very hard to see the councilman get to the state Senate, to see him suddenly abandon it and turn on everybody that helped him get to that state Senate seat, a state Senate seat that he was probably going to win handily, frankly, to see him turn on everyone that helped him get there. You know, like I said, politics ain't beanbag. God bless America. It's his right to do it, but it's pretty curious.
So now, as promised, I want to move on to issues. And the 6th District is largely agricultural. And I've spoken with farmers in this district over the last couple of years who say they're Republicans. They're not going to become Democrats because they disagree with the president on one issue. But they have said to me very plainly that the president's tariffs are hurting their livelihoods, and they would be interested in people who are willing to fight back against them. How are you going to essentially weigh your desire to support the president while also listening to your constituents who feel that some of his policies, like the tariffs, are genuinely hurtful to their livelihoods?
I don't envy the president's position on this issue, and I don't envy farmers who are on the receiving end of the costs involved in this issue. But what I experience from the farmers that I've talked to about this is, yes, the input costs, I mean, both what they put into their work and what they get out of their work, are nothing they control. It's unlike maybe any other industry in the country, and that's what makes farmers so unique. But the thing that farmers do understand is that for decades, our policies in this country have allowed foreign interests and entities to take terrible advantage of our farmers. They have had us over a barrel. We are just taking it in the pants when it comes to what we get for the sales of our agricultural products overseas versus what we're buying from other entities overseas. It's the trade imbalance has been wild. And this president has been the first one to take it head on and say, we're not just going to give away the farm, literally. It's got to be even, Stephen. Fair trade has got to be that, fair. You know, you sell your beans for a certain price, we sell our beans for a certain price. You don't get to hold us hostage and jack up your price on beans while we sell them for pennies on the dollar. Farmers instinctively know that. And so they know that President Trump is doing something that in the short term is painful, much like tackling Iran and the gas prices that ensued. That's not easy stuff, and it's not politically popular stuff, but it's decades-old problems that this president wants to solve. I think most farmers are with him on that. I will also say that I know that this president and the farmers are with him on this too. This president's looking into the consolidation of the meat processing industry, the big packers, as well as the fertilizer producers. There's terrible consolidation in agriculture right now, and it's forcing prices ever higher, and farmers don't have a way to compete with those price tags, and that's just wrong. And there's possibly, I'm not saying for sure, but there's possibly some monopolistic stuff going on that the DOJ under President Trump's direction is actively investigating right now. I'm really thrilled to hear about that. One more I'll throw in, right to repair. It is stunning to me, I've come to learn, that not only is equipment that you farm with, like a combine, $1 million product, not only is it that much money, but then you're held hostage and tied to that same company you purchased that combine for to repair it, to install new technology. They force you to do business with them. You can't repair it on your own. You can't take it to someone else to repair it. That's outrageous. So farmers have got to have more choice. We got to open the market to them. Farmers don't want for much. They just want certainty, and they're tired of being taken advantage of.
You kind of alluded to this earlier, but the fertilizer issue has become a major concern of farmers.
Huge.
Probably because what you mentioned, consolidation, but also because the Iran war has closed the Strait of Hormuz for way too long and is causing fertilizer imports not to come in. Is that, I guess this ties into the question of whether you think the Iran war was worth it. But do you think like decisions like that, which have really big short-term pain associated with it, makes decisions like attacking Iran end up in retrospect being not worth it?
Secretary Rubio said it very well, I think. And of course, I'm not in the room. So I voted for President Trump 3 times. I trust that he is making sound decisions and he sees things that I don't see. But he and Secretary
I'm
going to
interrupt
Rubio,
you because I interrupted Nate Willett during. I'm shocked that Donald Trump didn't let you into the Situation Room right before he attacked Iran. Just like
I tried.
I'm surprised he didn't brief Kansas City Council members on that. Yeah. That is just terrible on Donald Trump's part.
They're not fond of bringing talk show hosts into the room. I guess I've asked, but they don't want to do that. But the truth be told, though, what is interesting is I was at the White House apparently the day before they decided to launch on Iran. That was right after the State of the Union, as you remember. And there was a lot of activity that day at the White House. I now know what that was about. While I was meeting with several members of his cabinet, he was having Situation Room meetings about moving on Iran. So that ended up being sort of fortuitous, I guess, a little bit. But the decision that was made, I am very confident that principals in the room told President Trump, if you do this, do you understand what will happen to the market? What will happen to gas prices? They'll go through the roof. They'll shut down the strait. I know that was presented to the president. I'm certain of it. And I think the president said, we must go forward anyway. And the reason is, and Secretary Rubio, back to him, said it so well. He said, listen, they were getting close to a place where not only were they nuked up, but they had drone technology to defend themselves from anyone trying to stop them. And they were in a position, says this administration, says the president and Secretary Rubio, they were in a position where very soon they could control that strait in perpetuity and nobody could stop them. And these high prices on our fertilizer and our fuel would be permanent. And so I think the threat was real. I also think what's come out of this, and nobody really talks about it, Jason, is the fact that OPEC nations are starting to wither. And we're starting to talk about new ways beyond the strait to get oil to market. We're starting to talk about OPEC nations breaking off, UAE being one of them. Maybe more of these moderate Muslim nations joining the Abraham Accords. I think this strike on Iran was, yes, about safety and security, but more than that, sort of the bank shot off of it is going to be a region that I think is falling away from being intimidated by Iran, and I think is opening commerce in the Middle East and going to change the entire relational dynamic, which I think is going to impact fuel prices and a whole lot of things, again, for decades to come. I think that's how foundational what President Trump has done really is.
Your answer was pretty clear on this, but if you had been in Congress, you would have voted no on war powers resolutions to stop Trump from attacking Iran. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. What the president saw, he decided to move on. It wasn't a declaration of war. It was a short-term move, and I support that.
I want to talk about healthcare because I was watching a video that you were doing in front of a Ray County hospital and talking about how they're struggling. Before I ask the question, just to remind our listeners why you thought rural hospitals were struggling before I ask one of the possible solutions to it.
In my travels through North Missouri, everywhere you find a rural hospital, I think I don't remember over the last decade the number exactly. I feel like it was 7 or 8 rural Missouri hospitals have closed in the last decade. And as you understand, when most of North Missouri is in fact rural, and you're talking about maybe sometimes hundreds of miles from homes to hospital, those seconds can count in emergencies or when women would like to have, you know, a family, babies, deliver babies in a medically protected way. Driving hundreds of miles in an emergency situation is a bad thing. And when people ask me, how do we protect rural communities? How do we regrow and reinvest these communities? One of the first things has got to be medical care and that somebody can get to it quickly. And so these rural communities that still have small rural hospitals, they're scared to death that they're going to lose them. And one of the things that I know is all of this fraud that we've been seeing, and you've heard it covered. I mean, just this week it was announced $6.8 billion over 41 states has been uncovered in Medicare and Medicaid fraud. And that's just scratching the surface, I'm sure. Taxpayers are being taken for a ride. There's plenty of money to help these rural hospitals and keep them propped up, but they're short-handed, they're short-staffed, they don't have people that want to come work there because you can obviously make more money in the larger hospital systems in bigger cities. So the federal government can do better protecting the taxpayer dollars that exist to help these rural hospitals stay afloat. And I can talk to you about more specific things that I've heard inside some rural hospitals.
I'll bring up one thing. I want to bring up one thing right now. I was talking with the leader of one rural hospital during the Big Beautiful Bill debate, and they said in no uncertain terms that Congress and the president's decision to restrict the medical provider tax is going to be devastating to rural hospitals once it hits Missouri in 2028, 2029, and 2030. Now, this is something that Josh Hawley has said he wants to reverse before it goes into effect. If you're in Congress, what is going to be your thought process on that, given that it probably will get reversed after President Trump is out of office? Mm-hmm. But that is something that rural hospital leaders have told me is a big problem.
Yeah, it without any kind of counterweight or countermeasures, for sure. That specific provision, obviously, I'd need to study in more detail. And having a network of rural hospital executives that I've been talking with, I'm eager to continue to dive in on it. There are lots, as you know. This is healthcare in general in this country is a decades old problem, and it's multi-layered. Yeah. So there's lots to unpack here. One of the things I will say stunned me, and I won't name the hospital or the executive, but this particular hospital allows people, if they wish, to pay cash after their services. So let's say you have a $200,000 hospital bill from this particular hospital, and maybe you're a Medicaid or Medicare patient or what have you. They told me they have the ability to offer cash payment arrangement that they would happily literally wipe 50% of that hospital bill away and work on a cash payment structure with the patient, cutting their costs in half, rather than go through negotiating the pennies on the dollar reimbursement level they get through the government. And they, here's the thing about that, they can't advertise it, Jason. They cannot even offer that as an option to patients, which I think is bizarre. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that everybody can pay cash for their medical services. That's not my point. My point is how artificial the market is. When a hospital says, we can wipe half your bill away and get into a payment plan that'll cost you half the balance rather than go through the government transfer payment system and still make money, the rural hospital tells me. There's something wrong with that, it seems to me. And I don't, if we can empower the consumer, the patient, to cost compare and shop and more aggressively price things for themselves and give them some purchase power, take out the middleman, certainly government, I'm all for that. That seems to be at least one somewhat of a solution.
I want to talk about another issue that has divided both political parties. And as a political journalist, I love it when the parties are fighting with each other. I'm sure you do too.
Yeah, it was good for talk radio.
It was AI regulation. That has been something that I think has come before Congress a lot. There are some people that want to allow states to regulate artificial intelligence. There are some that don't, that want just it to be regulated federally. Some Republicans really like AI. I know Eric Burleson has been really critical of people who have been critical of AI, and some people think AI is the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
Where do you fall on this continuum, given that this is absolutely something that is going to come before you if you get elected to Congress?
I'm a realist in that I'll say whether I love it or hate it, and I have big concerns about it. I have cultural concerns about it. I have ethical concerns about it. I have workforce concerns about it. And so despite all those concerns, it's coming. It's here. And it's growing fast. And one of the things we know it needs to feed this beast is energy. So dovetailing, and this is not really on point, I'll get back to AI specifically in a minute, but it matters.
No, data centers is AI. So I think you're about to make that point, but continue.
Yeah. And so you know very well the fight that's going on right here in Missouri right now. And again, across 33 counties in North Missouri, the real worry, as some are being built and some are proposed to being built, I hear from political figures who say privately, do you know the revenue that could come into our community with these data centers? Publicly, though, you will hear from people in those communities that don't believe these things are any good for their community at all. They believe them for various reasons, whatever it be, water use, energy use, potential noise, light pollution, what have you. There's not a lot of transparency in the discussion. What bothers me about it is citizens don't feel like they have a seat at the table to talk about it. And I would rather people of means these data center companies, these tech companies, AI companies. I would rather they come into these communities. They've got the money to do it. You know, we're in the business of broadcast and marketing. Talk to people, spend some money, sit down, host some sessions, tell people what you are and aren't. Tell them what the benefits are. Tell them what the risks are or aren't. Just talk. All people want is to be heard and listen to them. What they don't like are non-disclosure agreements with political figures behind closed doors. And then they're just told, well, this is coming, like it or not. Now, I also believe, I will say, I do believe there is a tremendous effort from China to propagandize this, to scare the wits out of Americans into pushing back so forcefully that we stay out of the game while they build those things at a record clip, just like they do coal-fired power plants. China wants to eat our lunch on it. And my understanding is at present we lead. President Trump wants to continue to lead on it. I think he believes going forward it's going to be here and the economic driver of the future. So we can either lead the charge or fall behind China. And I think China aggressively wants to convince the American public we should sit on the sidelines while they go forward. I would rather big tech engage citizens in their own, if you want, propaganda campaign and share with them why it's a good thing and why they shouldn't be fearful, why citizens shouldn't be fearful. Yeah.
Yeah. And just to be clear, you don't want Congress to say that states and local communities cannot regulate data centers at all.
Correct.
Because I want to make this clear. There was a provision in the Big Beautiful Bill that would have prohibited state regulation of AI that would have absolutely meant that they could not regulate data centers. So this is a pertinent issue to federal lawmakers. So I interrupted you. You can answer my question now.
No, I get it. Local input on these things has to matter. You cannot slap a data center in someone's community and not allow them to have a voice on that. I'm pretty firm on that. The less government intervention on these sorts of things, the better. Look, I understand the argument. Again, the argument is if we make the technological advancements to keep up in the AI race difficult and more cumbersome and they become slowed down with bureaucracy and different fights from state to state, I understand the ambition and the interest and the eagerness. Hey, we've got to hurry. This is an arms race. Foot on the gas pedal. Let's not put up a bunch of roadblocks and impediments. I hear that argument. Having said that, it matters more to citizens across North Missouri that they understand and that they're heard and they understand what's coming into their community. Is it a net positive? Is it a net negative? Is it a wash? Is it not as bad as they thought? Is it every bit as bad as they thought? Let's talk about it. I mean, let people have their say. Let's just be out in the open about it. Transparency, as we are, as we know in media, sunshine is the best disinfectant. Just tell the truth. Be transparent.
I want to talk about immigration. And one of the things that I think has been lost in this debate over immigration, which has been kind of surprising to me, is there hasn't been as much emphasis on going after companies that employ people who are not in this country legally. And one of the ways that I think you could incentivize companies to stop hiring people who are not in this country legally is by mandating what's known as E-Verify that checks the immigration status for everybody. In Missouri, it is only contractors or like state government agencies that have to use E-Verify. If you're a member of Congress, would you want to expand the use of E-Verify to basically private and public entities?
Oh, absolutely. Fully supportive of that. I was just talking with a hog farmer yesterday. He hires some folks from South Africa to come here, and he has to go through the government to do it. It was a fascinating process, one that I didn't understand. He has to supply housing for a certain period of time. We've got to take this burden off of small business in particular. They can't look. The very basic function of the federal government should be to provide for the common defense. It's in the preamble, for heaven's sakes. And providing for the common defense means securing our borders and understanding who's coming in. We don't need to. Heaven knows government's big enough and well-funded enough. We don't need to pass the buck onto the makers in this country, people who are trying to build businesses and hire people and grow and create an economy. We don't need to pass the burden of what should be the federal government's responsibility onto them.
Okay, I got to just re-ask that question because you said, yes, you want E-Verify, but your answer seems to think that that would be burdensome to businesses. So is your answer no, you don't want to force companies to use E-Verify?
Well, I'm saying that the e-verify system in my, now granted, I've not used it, so I don't understand how cumbersome it may be, but my understanding is the e-verify system is a net positive and an easier tool for most employers than it is for them to verify on their own whether someone's in compliance or not. That's my
Got it.
understanding.
Got it. Just wanted to clarify a
Yeah.
couple of campaign questions before I let you go.
Sure.
So this is one of the interesting things about the new redistricting process. If we were under the old map, I would not pay any attention to the general election because the old district, the old sixth district is like 70-30 Republican. The new district is about 60-40 Republican because you're adding all of Clay County to it. And I think whoever wins this primary is probably going to be the next congressperson. But my question for you is, if we're in a 2006 style Democratic wave election, are you expecting a closer general election than usual? And the reason I ask this is if you go back to 2008, Ike Skelton won re-election that year with 65% of the vote, and Russ Carnahan won re-election with over 60% of the vote. 2 years later, Ike Skelton lost by two, albeit in a very Republican district. He was kind of an anomaly. And Russ Carnahan only beat Ed Martin by like one. So things can change really quickly. And my question for you is, are you expecting a closer general election than usual if you use the new six district lines?
I suspect it'll be closer simply because there are new names involved. As you know, Sam Graves won his last election with 72% of the vote. It was an all-time high for him. Now, of course, none of us are Sam Graves, so starting afresh with a new name on the ballot naturally means there's some work to do and some ground to be gained. But it's interesting you point out 2008. That was the year of Barack Obama. And 2 years later, you mentioned those Democrats started to backslide and Ike Skelton lost. That's also thanks to Barack Obama. And since 2008 and going forward, we've seen the American left only tack harder and harder and harder left. Case in point, what we just saw in New York, straight up, full blown, unapologetic socialists who now speak actively and openly about the destruction of the current system of American government. The Democrat Party has become something that is unrecognizable, not just ideologically a bit different than Republicans. It's now something that is actively hostile to our current system of government. And I believe if they continue to tack as hard as they are, I think it's going to inspire people who have been on the fence, on the bubble, maybe call themselves moderate, soft Democrat. I think people are going to be left with no choice soon. They either go with the party of total destruction, or they go with the Republican Party and the Republican candidate on the ballot. And so I have faith that ultimately, if the Democrats continue to trend this way, Republicans are only going to gain.
Do you think that President Trump has hurt that message by basically becoming best friends with the New York mayor?
I don't think President Trump's become best friends with the New York mayor. I
They
think
see
that,
he has a lot of riz, so I understand why he wants to be next to him. But I've heard this argument from you and Eric Schmidt, and I go back to that press conference where he was praising Mondami vociferously. That's not a word, but like I just feel like Trump is not really helping your message here, basically.
President Trump admires somebody who has f figured it out, who has mastered the craft. I think he has to tip his hat to somebody who's figured it out. But ideologically, there's not a bit of Zoran Mamdani's policies that President Trump admires. I think you have to tip again. You have to tip your hat to somebody who knows how to compete, and that's the scary thing, Jason, is this is a competitive message. What's alarming to me is the message of Zoran Mamdani is actually working. And that's frightening because if the people of this country begin to believe that we've got to be a command and control economy, there's no coming back from that. So you have to respect it. That's the thing. You can't dismiss it. You have to respect the fight. And President Trump respects fighters, but that doesn't mean he's not going to fight to defeat them.
Well, thank you so much for joining our show and for all of our stories. Go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a part of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the system. And Chris, how could people find out more about your congressional campaign, either on the World Wide Web or on social media?
Thanks, Jason. Yeah, you can follow me along at Chris Stigall on all the social media, CHRISSTIGALL, or you can go to stigallforcongress.com if you'd like to read more about the campaign.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long.
Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, creating laundry rooms with improved storage, workspace, and everyday function for one of the home's most used spaces. Inspiration at callmosby.com.